The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, there are lots of head colds and sore throats and stomach bugs and COVID around at the moment, just as the holiday season is upon us. But how can we tell if they're serious or not? And also, what medicines should we be packing for our holidays abroad? I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Brendan O'Shea, a GP and Medical Director of KDOC. Brendan, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, what's around at the moment? Because there are loads of people going missing, including some pilots at Aer Lingus. People are reporting COVID in somewhat significant numbers.
Well, look, there's two answers to your really good question in terms of what's around. On one hand, the pragmatic answer is all the usual things plus COVID are around. And that's the totality of kind of seasonal viral illnesses. There's the hay fever crowd are in difficulty. So there's all that is going on. That's the relaxed answer. It's the practical answer, to be honest. Then there's a very forensic scientific answer, which reflects the fact that over the last decade, we've got ever more precise and scientific about naming every single dreaded organism that's just about to leap upon us. And that makes for a very worried existence. So I think probably somewhere there's middle ground. And really, it's useful to explore how we can be practical and pragmatic. And if we're lucky enough to be enjoying well-earned holidays coming up, that we can make that safe and comfortable for everybody.
Now, the question is, how do you know when something is serious? You get a small child who's complaining about something, it could be pointing to their throat and explaining that it's a bit sore. I mean, how do you know when to act?
Well, this is something we see every single day in practice, and there's an amazing range of parental response. And if the parental response isn't providing definition, there's usually a cue of aunts, uncles and in-laws and outlaws. So it becomes really very important. Most people, most parents are really fantastic at this. We've done a lot of messaging on this over the years, but it is the bottom line. How do we know this is moving on from just a cough, cold, runny nose, a cold, to a more significant infection? The process is fairly straightforward. What's especially transmissible and what everybody gets is they get viruses. Yeah. Droplet spread, we know that inside out. For the majority of people, for 19 out of 20 people or more, it's a 10, 12, 14 day self-limiting illness. The first 5 or 7 days are usually the worst. Temperature, coryzal symptoms is what we call them, snuffles, cough, off our appetite, and tips along. And in that phase, and when it's purely viral, usually the victim, the patient, the child or whoever it is, they tend to respond reasonably well to paracetamol. That's always a reassuring thing. It doesn't make it go away, but if the symptoms get easier on paracetamol, that's a good sign. Another really good sign is fluid intake, and particularly for smaller children, toddlers and infants. If they're taking at least half the usual amount over 24 hours that they usually do, plus if they're in reasonable form and responding to paracetamol, that's a very good indication that it's really all right to manage it on a day-by-day basis. And especially for most kids who don't have complex medical backgrounds. On the other hand, if the fluid intake falls below that, and then maternal instinct is really the most accurate. We're thinking, we're wondering whether there's something serious. Usually there isn't. If there's something serious going on, parents absolutely always know. They know and to professionalise. So that's a conversation with a pharmacist. It's ring a practice, it's ring a clinic and have a discussion and a conversation about it.
Do we know, are many doctors still doing online consultations? A lot were doing during COVID.
Oh, that's very interesting. And that is a debate that's quietly raging within the medical profession. Everybody emotively likes the certainty of a face-to-face consultation. Everybody likes that. Patients like it, people like it, relatives like it, and a lot of doctors like it as well. But the science really doesn't stack up. That's against the science. We've done surveys. People report a high level of satisfaction with telephone medicine if it's set up well, and particularly with a clinic where they're known. And also the science around cost and wise use of scarce resources. Mm-hmm. It's far more efficient. And then there's the environmental piece, having people traveling from A to B and C and pieces of paper and so on and so forth.
And also mixing with the people who are really sick in the surgery. in the waiting room.
Yeah. The science around telemedicine is absolutely compelling. It's one of the largely, and this is answering your question, one of the largely forgotten benefits of the pandemic. And certainly, like I say, we do debate among ourselves in our cooperative. Should we bring them in? Should we not? What would they like? What can we actually do? But certainly, in the round, the level of telemedicine has probably gotten significantly less. There are niche spaces around that. The people who have private health insurance, relentlessly market telemedicine. And so therefore, people who have health insurance are likely, and I'm speculating here this morning, are likely to have greater access and exposure to telemedicine. And overall, from a systems point of view, and often for the patient, that's a good thing.
All right. Now, you say maternal or paternal instinct. I'm not sure how strong the paternal is, but certainly parents watch their kids and they can see the degree of change and how sustained that change will be.
Yes, the paternals are getting very slowly better over the decades, but they need every bit of encouragement. Again, the dialogue is interesting. Well, how sick is he or how sick is she? Oh my God, it's terrible and really out of sorts and like a bag of cats. But when you drill into it, we spike a temperature, we have some paracetamol. Continue the paracetamol, keep the paracetamol going consistently throughout the illness and you'll have a better experience. But when we get a good, reasonably good response to paracetamol in terms of irritability and fluid intake, that's a very reassuring thing. So try to avoid snap decisions. And it can happen after you go to the beautiful hotel or wherever, and after 6 nights of awake all night coughing and exhaustion sets in, you can make a snap decision. My God, this is just terrible, and panic. But again, you just go back over the recent history. Really, really brilliant parents can tell you to the mil or the ounce the amount of fluids in the previous 24 hours. So there is a spectrum in terms of how effective people are at responding. There's a lot of variables feed into that. But generally, people are really great. It's fantastic. So many of us are going to be fortunate to have holidays. And we should think of the people who aren't fortunate to have holidays. They're greatly looked forward to. And it's just really important to make the most of them.
Now, you mentioned most of the bugs that people are coming down with are viral. And the question is, am I transmitting my own virus to somebody else? And
yes,
how long after I'm afflicted might I be safe from transmitting to other people?
Well, in terms of transmitting viral illnesses, nobody is safe, to be honest. And I mean that absolutely in a scientific sense. You almost certainly will be infectious for a couple of days before you develop symptoms. During that first 5 or 7 days, the days of coughs, snots and spluttering, you're highly infectious. You're radiating virus particles and droplet spread. So all the catechism, and that's the word, all the catechism we learnt around social distancing is relevant to that. And especially if you happen to be in contact with people who are vulnerable and you know who some of them are, their elderly relatives, grannies, aunts, uncles, or don't go and visit people in a hospital. And there are others that you won't know about. So it's a kind of, you know, there's a societal contract there just to be sensible.
Okay.
It's good practice to mask up, for example, if you have to be in a public area.
Yeah. You anticipated my next question, which is when you're going on your holliers, should you be wearing a mask on the plane?
There is no absolutely right answer. What we can understand, the difference among the flying public from 2019 to 2024 is really significant. The flying public now has very substantial levels of immunity against COVID, either through having had the infection or having had their immunizations. And for the people, I certainly absolutely keep up to speed with my immunizations. But there's no satisfactory answer. I think if we were being absolutely logical, fewer of us would be traveling abroad. We would be staying at home. We would be avoiding highly crowded, highly densely populated spaces like airports. That's the rational answer that nobody out there wants to hear this morning.
All right. People commenting, I often develop colds and sore throats after being on a plane and they often blame the air conditioning and so on. Is it simply the case that the holiday season in Ireland makes Ireland more vulnerable to imported viruses? People go off on the holidays, become infected and bring something strange back.
I think as a theoretical construct, I think that that may well be correct. Getting into the nerdy, geeky part of this, apparently sitting in an aeroplane in a seat strapped in, you're at significantly lower risk because of laminar airflow going from the top to the bottom. The air conditioning is organised like that. The really hot spots are the queues where you've got people standing in line very close together, kids running around the place in between legs and around luggage carts. That's particularly where the pickup is. So, you know, go to the remote, beautiful west of Ireland, can't you?
Okay. Ask the doctor about the 100-day cough. I'm on day 75. It will not go. I got an X-ray that says I'm completely fine, but I don't feel fine. That's Fiona.
This is dreadful and exhausting. The original cough of 100 days was whooping cough, which very aggressive and not infrequently fatal and caused very serious complications, including bronchiectasis, for example. We do see this in practice. Fortunately, it afflicts very small numbers. It's not a new thing. It's been known for quite a while. But what we understand is that sometimes with particular individuals and particular viral illnesses more than anything else, that combination of their genes and this virus results in a very heightened cough reflex. So it's like feathers in the back of your throat, and it just it can almost bring you to desperation. When we see this in practice, we do chapter and verse, go through the history, examine, work up any examination findings. Ultimately, when it's going on, you end up doing a chest X-ray and you understand almost certainly it's going to be normal. But there's a need to do it because rarely the underlying cause will be something different and something sinister. So everybody is different. We're now looking at very small percentages who get to the 50-day cough. There's a range of different things we can do in terms of cough suppression and cough suppression medication. But it is very difficult. Ultimately, the prognosis is very good. It eventually stops. For the vast majority of people. Rarely you'll uncover unlikely or unusual diagnosis as part of following the illness. But for most people,
it will resolve even if it takes 100 days. Now, finally, Brendan, I should ask you about what goes into the medicine bag when you're heading off on halls.
Oh, that's a very specific question, and it depends on the composition of the family. So the under 5 year olds, you bring industrial quantities of pediatric paracetamol, you bring industrial quantities of pediatric ibuprofen, you bring industrial quantities of factor 50 or factor 75 sunblock. It's good to bring an antiseptic cream. It's good to bring 1% hydrocortisone. And it's also good, if you don't have it, to pick up a very cheap yellow pack first aid kit. So that's standard kit for a family of under fives. Don't forget the regular medication. And if the asthma inhalers, for example, are getting low and you get a viral illness while you're on holidays and you run out, that's very inconvenient. It's difficult to organize these things in a strange environment where you don't have your local friendly pharmacist or your GP nurse or GP to bail you out. Beyond that, if you're traveling with older people, and most people over 50 have at least one or two long-term illnesses, it's good maybe for them to bring a copy of their medical record printed out. It's particularly good if they're on more than two or three medications to bring a current printed list of their medication. If you have to be seen in a casualty department, for example, or a clinic, it really speeds things up and reduces risk if you can clearly communicate what your conditions are and what your medication is. And it's also, there's nothing more soul destroying when you're a GP in Ireland and you've got a traveller in your local cooperative and you have to go through 10 medications in Spanish. That's a real heart sink. So bring those lists with you.
Right. Finally, some questions about COVID. I tested positive for COVID 2 days ago. Very breathless first day. Absolutely floored with all symptoms today. Chesty cough, breathless, headache, sore eyes, blocked nose. What's best remedy, please? Can I get steroids prescribed for my chest? Another one, thank you for covering this. I'm at home isolating in my room away from my two small kids who are dying for a squeeze, and my poor husband has carried the can all week. HSE website says 5 days. I'm on day 4. I can't wait for tomorrow, although my husband is suggesting I wait until Saturday. Please advise.
Well, that's not a question. That's 10 questions. But cheers for you for going into your miserable bedroom and doing the right thing and not hopefully passing it on to your two kids, who in turn almost certainly would pass it on to several others. So cheers for doing the dull, boring, important right thing. So again, I'd refer to those yardsticks. We often are asked, would antibiotics help? Would steroids help? If you are one of the less than 1 in 20 who gets a secondary bacterial infection, and that could either be a really septic throat and you can't swallow fluids, a really bad persistent middle ear infection, or a lower respiratory tract infection and you start coughing up large amounts of green sputum and you're short of breath, then an antibiotic would be helpful. Steroids are generally not helpful except for very specific subgroups. If an individual has moderate to severe asthma and they know it's going to spiral out of control around this, then certainly telemedicine consultation with your GP or GP or GP cooperative or insurance doctor would be the next step. So everybody is different, really. We're very complicated. Families are complicated. People are complicated. But there are these key principles. And if you can apply them consistently, you'll come out the other end of it.
Dr. Brendan O'Shea, a GP Medical Director at KDOC, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.